From the margins with Ask Rashid here in CKDU 88.1 in Halifax. I'm talking with Chris Dixon, a longtime anti-authoritarian organizer, writer, and educator who recently received his PhD from the University of California at Santa Cruz. He lives in Sudbury, Ontario, where he's involved with anti-war and Indigenous solidarity organizing. Dixon serves on the board of the Institute for Anarchist Studies and the advisory board for the journal Upping the Ante. He is currently completing a book tentatively titled Against and Beyond, based on interviews with anti-authoritarian organizers across the U.S. and Canada involved in broader-based movements. Thanks for doing this, Chris.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here.
All right, so we could just jump right into the idea of this book that you're in the process of working to complete. Can you please describe the idea of the book and what motivated you to write it?
Yeah, this book basically came out of my own experiences as an activist and organizer starting in the 1990s. I've been involved in radical politics and movements for about 20 years. And I was deeply involved in organizing for the Seattle WTO protest in 1999, the protest against the World Trade Organization ministerial that became sort of synonymous with what was sometimes called the anti-globalization movement, but which I'll most likely call the global justice movement for our conversation today. And out of those organizing experiences, I realized that there were a lot of young and very dynamic organizers like me who were beginning to think a lot about politics and social transformation and how we're going to make a revolution in North America, and at the same time coming up against some pretty steep barriers to actually accomplishing that. And so in the early 2000s, I went to graduate school. And I went to graduate school with the express purpose of trying to further the discussions that were already happening in the movements that I was a part of. I wanted to actually tap into the debates, look at some of the challenges that we were facing, and try and help us move. Because I saw so much potential, and I was seeing so many people who were actually moving in the direction of thinking about organizing, not just with other people who were self-identified activists, but with ordinary people, people who didn't identify as activists, migrants, working people, indigenous people, all sorts of folks who were not sort of already caught up within activist scenes. And I thought that there was a lot of promise in that and worth tapping into. And so this book actually came out of the research that I then did through much of the 2000s, and specifically a set of interviews that I conducted in 2006 and 2007 with about 50 organizers in 7 different North American cities who are involved in all sorts of different long-term campaigns and organizations trying to actually move radical politics in broader spaces. So, I mean, that's sort of the core of the book. We can get into some of the bigger ideas associated with it, but that's really the kind of motivation behind it.
And I'm sure we'll get into this as well, but did the idea evolve along the way, or did you have this hard fixed idea and you just stuck with it? Like, do you want to talk anything about that?
That's a great question. Of course the idea evolved. I don't think any good book can actually start with just an idea that stays with that idea, particularly a book that's about engaging with the dynamism of movements and organizing that's happening, right? Because everything's always changing. And our political conditions are changing too. And if we're smart, we're changing in response to changing political conditions. So just specifically in relation to this project, when I first started working on it, the global justice movement was still really kind of in an upswing. And I had imagined in some ways that I would be writing a book that was largely about people who identified as anarchists or identified with a kind of anti-statist, anti-capitalist politics who were involved in confrontations at large summit protests, and then trying to move that energy beyond those instances into broader-based organizing in communities and workplaces. But of course, what we saw is that over the course of 2001 to, let's say, about 2004, there was a remarkable downturn in North America with that kind of organizing. And many of the people who had been deeply involved in that didn't simply give up on radical politics, but they moved elsewhere. They went into other sorts of spaces. In Canada, many of them got involved in things like anti-poverty organizing, with, say, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty or the various kind of spin-offs of coalitions against poverty in various places, or in No One Is Illegal collectives in many cities. And those are just a few examples. So I had to follow. I had to follow where people were going. And at the same time, I had to step back and actually pay attention to the fact that this was the stream of politics and the kind of trajectory of organizing that I came out of. But there were other streams. There were other strands that I think were bringing people to similar kinds of political conclusions and similar lessons about organizing and organization building. But they were coming from other places. They were coming out of, for example, organizing against prisons.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get into all that. Now, an interesting concept that you brought up in your summary of the book that you sent me was bringing together social movements to challenge what you describe as no, quotation marks, and as well, these people coming together for something called yes. Mm-hmm. So do you want to elaborate on no and yes?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's important to say that the no and the yes, this is not my idea. You know, this is just a way that I tried to summarize some things that I was seeing. And of course, the no and the yes in some ways come from the Zapatistas, those rebels in Chiapas, Mexico, who came into worldview in 1994 with the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement. And they talk about the one no and the many yeses, the idea that we're saying no or rejecting the world as it is, organized around capitalism and a whole set of inequalities and forms of exploitation and oppression. And at the same time, we're saying many yeses. We're saying yes to many alternative forms of how we organize our societies and our lives. I took these terms, and I was also influenced by a person by the name of John Holloway, who is sort of a political philosopher who spent a lot of time in Mexico and has himself been deeply influenced by the Zapatistas. And he has talked a bit about the no, especially. But in any case, when I say the no and the yes, I'm trying to identify aspects that I think are central to any kind of authentically radical organizing that's going to have any hope of fundamentally changing how things exist in the world. And I think there have to be these two parts, and they always have to go together. I think we're in danger, in fact, if we just focus on one or the other. The first is the no. And by the no, what I mean is a rejection of domination, of exploitation, of oppression, of any form of power over in which you have certain people who are controlling the lives and destinies of other people. And I think that I think we can actually see a lot in existing forms of radical activism, right? We say no to a particular free trade agreement. We say no to a particular immigration regime that controls people's futures and whether they can exist on one side of a border or another. We say no to police violence as it occurs all the time in certain communities, right? Those are our rejections of these kinds of forms of violence that are happening around us. The yes, I think, is about us trying to imagine a different future. But too often, we think in these ways that are so disconnected from where we actually are, and we think about these kinds of utopian fantasies of how the world could be. And I'm certainly not saying that it's a bad idea to do some intentional visioning about what we would like to accomplish. But I do think that it's also important to be thinking about how we start to build those structures into what we're doing right now. So there have been small examples of this, right? Like, people think about, well, how do we develop forms of very intentional participatory democracy in the kinds of organizing that we're engaged in as a way to show a kind of projected view, maybe on a small scale, of the future that we would like to create. But I think that's actually only one example. I mean, I think when we talk about trying to build organizations that can create spaces where we confront things like racism and sexism within the very modes of organizing that we're using, we're trying to actually create a yes, create a different possibility of how we can be together, how we can collectively work together, a yes that can in fact point to a different way of socially organizing ourselves in the future. And I think the yes in many ways is an open question too, about what kinds of institutions can we be building right now that can concretely be meeting people's needs in ways that don't bolster the current system as it is. At previous points in history, radical movements, I think, have taken this much more seriously. Of course, I often think about the Black Panther Party in the United States and its ability to construct massive free breakfast programs for young black children, as well as health clinics and all the other sorts of things. And these were not reliant on the existing system, right? They were alternatives to it. They were the pieces of a new society.
So you mentioned you did quite a number of interviews for the book. Can you give some examples of some people you interviewed?
Mm-hmm. I interviewed people in Canada. I interviewed people in Vancouver, Toronto, and Montreal. In the United States, I interviewed people in San Francisco, New York, and I actually went to New Orleans for a while as well to look at the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and the kinds of grassroots reconstruction efforts that were happening there. What I was actually looking for was to connect with people who haven't written a lot, but are doing really solid organizing work on the ground. And I wanted to find people who were involved in a wide variety of different kinds of organizing efforts. I didn't want to focus on people who were all in one scene, but who were, you know, I wanted to find sort of a collection of people who were traversing a lot of different campaigns and areas of focus and points of struggle. Because I didn't want it to just be like, here's this sort of collection of friends, right? These sort of little radical cliques that are having conversations just with themselves.
Which could have been a really easy thing to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you also mentioned in your summary about the four anti-authoritarian strands.
Mm-hmm.
So you identified these four strands. Do you want to just elaborate on these strands?
Yeah, for sure. So part of what I'm trying to do in this book project, in hopefully in some useful and effective ways, is talk about what I understand right now as an anti-authoritarian current. And when I say the term anti-authoritarian current, I'm actually talking about a kind of set of strands that have come together, I think, within the last 5 to 10 years around a loosely shared politics that is an anti-statist, anti-capitalist politics, but is also very, very interested in organizing and organization building. And to understand what is right now, I think we have to think about the immediate history leading into that. So that's why I talk about four strands. And I think one of those strands, undoubtedly, is what was happening with anarchist politics in North America in the 1990s. And I think this is kind of an overlooked moment. And there's, of course, lots to talk about in that period. And it's, I think, also very easy to be dismissive about it. But it is true that during the 1990s, there was an amazing network of anarchist activists and organizers who were largely politicized in the wake of the first Gulf War and the OCA crisis, who were trying to figure out how to connect and work together on larger scales. And you know, many of them were connected through institutions like info shops, which are basically radical bookstores and community centers that people put together in various communities. There are many info shops still now. And there were a whole set of radical periodicals that people put out, magazines and zines that circulated and allowed for them to connect with each other. But basically, people within 1990s anarchism were, I think, beginning to wrestle with some big questions around movement building, about how to sort of move beyond simply anarchist-specific spaces and try and move radical politics on a much bigger scale. And what's interesting, of course, is sort of parallel to that, you saw the explosion of a lot of activity fighting against neoliberalism on a global scale. And of course, that extends in the Global South, extends back much further into the late 70s and the 80s. But with the rise of the Zapatistas in Mexico in 1994, there was an increased coherence with global struggles against neoliberalism. And anarchists in North America were paying a lot of attention to that. And I think that that level, that sort of heightened level of struggle against neoliberalism that was mainly coming from the South, was actually not so present in places like Canada and the United States, created the possibility for anarchists with politics that was based around, you know, direct action and confrontational protest, and also really wonderful sorts of creativity in terms of bringing art and, you know, forms of visualizing a new world into protest. That kind of collision of those forces in the late 1990s created the possibility for the global justice movement to happen. Now, of course, there were many other forces that came together there. But those are the first two strands that I think are really important in thinking about what is right now. The first being this kind of 1990s anarchism, and the second one being the rise of this kind of what I think of as an international revolt against neoliberalism, largely emanating from the South, and then people in the North kind of starting to pay attention more. And then I think there are two other strands that are really worth mentioning. The first, which is probably more present in the United States, although I don't think that we should diminish its presence in Canada, is the rise of a prison abolitionist politics. And these really developed, in the States at least, through a longer-term struggle against prisons that in many ways comes out of the black freedom tradition and the fact that so many radical black activists were thrown in prison in the 70s through state repression. But also there was kind of a growing movement and consciousness in the early 90s, especially around the development of what many people came to call the prison industrial complex, the interlocking set of institutions like prisons, like the criminal justice system, including policing and the court system, that were putting more and more people behind bars. In fact, an astonishing number of people behind bars, you know, on a scale that the world has never seen before. And out of this, in 1998, a whole set of activists involved in anti-prison politics, as well as some very important thinkers, came together at a conference called Critical Resistance. And this was in California. Out of that conference emerged an organization called Critical Resistance, which has really been on the leading edge of articulating a prison abolitionist politics. And by prison abolition, what I mean is a politics that tries to develop a future where there are no prisons, where we do not have to resort to putting people behind bars to deal with violence in our society. And I think that strand has a very unique political form to it, and is putting forward a vision that is kind of rocking the world, like that's so hard to even imagine, but is in fact really deeply radical in terms of thinking about all the different kinds of ways society would have to be restructured in order to not be reliant on prisons and cops. The fourth strand I wanted to mention coming into this moment is what I think of as radical women of color feminism, what in Canada is also sometimes called anti-racist feminism. And this emerges really on the margins of the women's liberation movement in the 1970s, where you have a whole number of radical women of color who are saying, this feminism does not actually represent my experience. And my experience is so much about the intersection of patriarchal relations, that is how sexism is manifested in a systemic way, racism and colonialism too, and capitalism, and in terms of actually structuring the experience of women who are facing oppression on multiple fronts. And women of color feminism over the last couple of decades has articulated a politics which has different names. In the academy, it's sometimes called intersectionality, the idea being that this whole intersection of systems of oppression is how we have to actually understand social reality, and that we can't actually fight just one form of oppression. We can't just go after capitalism and poverty. We have to at the same time be thinking about how capitalism and poverty are deeply implicated in racial relations and have a gender dimension to them all at the same time. That, of course, has implications for how people experience sexuality and on and on. So, very briefly, those are four strands that I think come in to this kind of emerging anti-authoritarian politics right now.
I'm calling a lot of the movements that you've alluded to as kind of being part of a bit of a fragmented set of scenes, a lot of cliquey anti-authoritarian and activist subcultures. Mm-hmm. I guess you didn't get into so much the subculture element yet, so hopefully get into a bit of that now. So this is kind of what I see, and you do mention a bit of that as well in your summary. So I'm wondering what you can say about some of the reasons for what we see out there in these kind of cliquey sorts of subcultures, and what might be the harmful effects of things going that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In many ways, actually, this project has, for me, come out of a deep concern I have about the kind of developing subcultures around activism, around radical activism in the US and Canada, where I think far too often we're content as activists to basically hang out with our friends and do the same things over and over again and not figure out ways to actually move beyond what we are and how we speak and the kinds of culture that we share with each other. Now, before I talk about subcultural scenes, though, I think it's important to recognize why they happen. And there are some good reasons why they happen. I remember in one of my interviews, I was having a really important discussion with Max Scott, who works with the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, as well as known as Illegal in Toronto. And we were talking about this very issue. And he said, you know, it's hard trying to transform society. And particularly when there are a lot of people who seem fairly content with the way things are. And then there are people who really are going to resist your every effort to try and radically change anything. So it makes sense that we try and create communities of people where we share the same views and have a relative sense of sort of safety and mutual understanding. The trouble is when, in creating those communities, we sort of hardened the outside walls of them and assume that all we really need to do is just bring more people into these tiny little radical activist scenes, rather than thinking about how do we actually work with people coming from a lot of different backgrounds, a lot of different ways of thinking about themselves, and a lot of different everyday cultures. And at the same time, I think it's important to think about what has happened with capitalism in the last 30 years. Whereas in the 1960s, capitalism was not so deeply enmeshed in the development of popular culture. Today, capitalism actually is completely focused on popular culture, right? Like, that's where there's so much money to be made. And in fact, subculture in that sense is about a new opportunity for a music company or a fashion designer to, you know, get rich. Even if that means the spikes on your hoodie or the new punk rock album that your friends put out, right? Those are opportunities for capitalism. And so in a certain way, subculture now is very much implicated in how people make money. And even as I, of course, participate in subcultures, I'm kind of constantly aware of the fact that it doesn't mean that in participating, even in what feels like a very radical subculture, I'm somehow stepping outside of capitalism. In fact, I may very well be playing into how it's accumulating more money. And, I mean, capitalism is very happy with us. You know, figuring out more ways to identify ourselves on Facebook and elsewhere, and then figuring out how to sell stuff to us on that basis. But, I mean, I think it's important to understand those contexts, right? Understand on the one hand that there are good reasons why we try and build community, and on the other hand that there are structural forces at play that move us into particular kinds of community and particular kinds of identification that actually marginalize us further. So, problems with subculture. This is kind of the core of the question I understand you to be asking me. I think there's a lot. I think one is that, and maybe here I'll speak specifically from my experience coming out of punk rock subculture, where I think there is a lot of emphasis on understanding ourselves as the enlightened few, those who have the sort of complete understanding of how messed up everything is in our society, and seeing ourselves really as kind of at the forefront of this understanding, and actually being very suspicious of anyone else who wants to kind of break in to our scene and claim to have any kind of understanding. And I think that's elitist. I think there's a certain kind of elitism that is often built in to the kind of subculture that we can build in radical activist scenes, where we actually see ourselves as we've got it, other people don't have it, and we maybe should just write them off, or maybe we should try and kind of recruit them into our mentality. But it's definitely not a mentality that's based around how do we organize together? How are we going to be transformed through a process of struggle where it's not just going to be about us with our correct answers, but actually about us engaging with people who have a whole range of experiences and all of us together moving someplace that we cannot yet see. So, I mean, I think that elitism is one problem. I think another problem is self-marginalization, where we take on all sorts of the trappings of militant rebellion that communicate within our very tiny circles to each other that, yes, we're really down to fight the system, but beyond our circles, they're not necessarily understandable to anyone else. Now, this is not me saying that, you know, we shouldn't be open to all kinds of forms of experimentation, but we should at the same time understand what role we're playing in creating spaces to be in dialogue with other people who don't necessarily understand what we're talking about and who we are. And, I mean, I also think this actually gets into some questions that I think are really crucial around how do we go about developing a strategy and why so often do we not think strategically. But I think sometimes what can go along with us being so cemented into radical subculture is that we get fixated on particular tactics that we think of as synonymous with what it means to be a radical activist. And there are many different examples of this, and in different historical periods there are different examples. I mean, during a certain moment in the 1980s, and for certainly part of the 1990s too, a particular kind of nonviolent civil disobedience was a key feature of what it meant to be a radical activist. You know, that you go and you get arrested in these mass direct actions, and you spend time in jail, and that's, you sort of get activist credibility that way, and that's what you do. And then there's an interesting break in the late 90s and the early 2000s where it becomes more fashionable in a certain way to be involved in forms of militant direct action where perhaps you're engaging in acts of property destruction and you're actually trying to not get arrested. You're trying to evade the police. And, you know, that becomes the sort of the tactic that makes you the most credible